Hello.
Hi, how are you?
How you guys doing?
Good. How are you doing? How's the family?
We're hanging in.
One of your family members out here? Definitely
Yep.
has an opinion.
What's that?
She definitely has an opinion.
Yes. Don't worry. She won't be attending the class. So.
I'm so not worried about it. Trust me, it wouldn't bother me at all.
Okay,
Did
no, she's good.
you get my note that my email I sent you?
So sorry. Yeah, I thought I didn't respond.
No, that's okay. I just thought it
So
was
sorry. I know
interesting.
you mentioned the book. It sounded really interesting. What's it called?
It's Eggshells on the Ceiling, but it's her family story, kind
Right.
of fictionalized, but it talked about the fact that in the 1940s that they were marrying off girls before they were 14 years old, and
Right, wow.
when they were being expelled, that period where they were had a few months, they didn't
Right.
want to take a journey from their hometown to the shore without every girl from 11 and older being married.
It's
They had the
crazy.
protection of the quote husband.
Right.
And so I just wondered if maybe they came over to Morocco with that practice, and so therefore it was part of the time, and they never changed
Right.
it because it
It's
stayed part of the
possible. I
time
mean,
in the Arab communities.
yeah, I'm definitely possible. I mean, it's, the practice is I don't know, maybe sadly not something that's so out of the ordinary at, certain times in history. So it's definitely
Right.
would
What
make
community
sense.
was it?
In the book, it was the Jewish community of Spain. And it was not,
The
yeah, well, before, and it was the wealthy community. The story, yes, it was the story was about a wealthy family, a wealthy community. It wasn't about,
Right.
people in the,
Yeah.
I'm sorry. It's like some cheesecake, we're trying to get rid of it.
Unfortunately, there are still
No
things
idea how much
technology has not overcome. Enjoy.
that. Thanks. As I said to David, it's almost time just to make it disappear because I don't think I
Yeah.
want to eat any more cheesecake.
Exactly. At least you won't have the guilt anymore, right?
That's true. Except for, yeah. I'm not feeling guilty, so maybe that's the
Okay.
problem.
I hear you. I know the feeling. I'll be right back.
Comes right back. I'm gonna delete. It's really hard to
Neither.
unmute this. Unmute us.
Hi. Hi, Toby.
Hi, how are you, Helene? Nice to
Okay,
see you.
good to see you. Congratulations on your appointment. Yes.
It's still have to get elected.
Oh, you got my vote. For
Thank
sure,
you.
yeah.
Yeah, it's a crazy time.
Oh, is it? Yeah, really. So many problems.
A lot to deal
Yeah.
with, but we'll try our best.
I hope I am. I've really been busy. Patients are calling me on the phone. I'm doing telephonic, and they really need it badly.
Well,
I haven't seen you too many classes, Helene. You must be really busy.
know because I've been busy on the phone. After a while, you can just take so much. I find it more exhausting.
Yeah.
Face to face.
Oh.
Interesting. No, it really is
Hi.
very draining.
It's 8 o'clock.
Hi, everyone. Okay, we'll start in
Hi.
1 minute. We'll just give the last couple of people an opportunity to get on.
Whatever you
I should
want.
just listen.
Hello.
Hello. Hi.
Okay.
Oh, you have someone on still?
Oh, no, I'm going to mute.
Okay.
Where do I get
But I don't know the Zoom for this number, this thing.
Bye, dear.
Okay, I think we'll start.
Could you please mute everyone, because in past calls we've had difficulty.
I'm going to.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Good evening, everyone. I am going to mute you, which again is nothing personal. Just to sound better. Okay. At any point, feel free to unmute yourselves. I'll stop for questions and comments at various points. But you don't have to wait till then. Okay, so feel free at any moment to unmute yourselves if you have a question or comment. This has been a really fun series for me, and hopefully for everyone. As I think I've mentioned, tonight's lecture, though, is going to be really fascinating, I think. I would say I think I used the word dicey last time. It is a pretty dicey topic. So I want to give a disclaimer beforehand. We're just talking about the facts and the history here. This is by no means an endorsement of anything which we will talk about. I'm happy to have those conversations, but not here tonight. Okay, it's a really, really fascinating topic, which brings us a lot closer to home. So as you saw, the topic of tonight's class, which we'll study together, is New York in 1935, okay? And again, just to give the general framework of the various periods and classes and topics that we've been talking about throughout this series, so I framed this like this a number of times already. The reasons I chose these specific, times and cities and events, although we could have probably chosen hundreds of different subjects to talk about. The reason we're talking about these is, I do believe, as I've said, they represent different experiences as various elements of the Sephardic world confronted modernity. And as again, we've said, the first class was about the Jews trying to gain acceptance back into England, right? So it was a Sephardic community trying to gain acceptance. The next class, which we spoke about, the Jews of Mashhad in Iran, was clearly an example of a community that was not accepted. They were persecuted. Last week, we spoke about a class where assimilation or quote-unquote acceptance was, in a way, imposed upon a community, various communities. It looks like not everyone is on mute, so let me just make sure that is taken care of. Again, at any moment, please just unmute yourselves if you have a question or a comment. And tonight, I want us to think about and learn about a community which is what I would call, and I don't mean this word in a bad way, but I would say fearful, okay? Fearful of the effects of modernity and assimilation and integration. Now, again, I'll give the disclaimer again. I don't endorse any of the practices that we'll talk about. I do have opinions on them, but I'm not going to share them, hopefully, tonight. But I am happy to have that conversation at a different time. But I do think it is a fascinating, fascinating subject, which hits closer to home because we're talking about the Syrian community of New York. And it's something that's still in effect till today, okay? It's still in effect. So the history is one which is still quite relevant, okay? So we'll put it that way. Let's give some background, okay? So the background is that the Syrian community of New York, the ones that are from Syria, and that'll be important also later on, you'll see why I'm saying that, but the ones that, the core that is from Syria itself, or that traces its origins to Syria, for the most part, and again, this is not as clear cut, but for the most part, divide into two different sub-communities. One is from Damascus, okay? They call themselves, I believe Shami, I'm not 100% sure what the origin of that term is, but Shami, I believe, is the ones who trace their origin to Damascus. And the one which we'll focus on more tonight are the ones that trace their origin to Aleppo. Okay. And in Hebrew, Aleppo is known as a couple of different names. One of them is Chaleb. Okay. And Syrian Jews till today who can trace their origins to Aleppo, very often call themselves Halabim. Okay, so from Aleppo, and we'll see where, maybe where that term comes from, at least a legend, okay? So Aleppo, it's been in the news, not the past couple of years, but for the past 10, 15 years, for tragic purposes, because of the Syrian civil war, there's, for as far as I know, maybe, you know, one or two, I don't know, maybe five Jews left in the city. But the Jewish community of Aleppo actually traces itself back. It's a very ancient Jewish community. It traces itself back till
Rabbi.
Yeah.
Are you sure that Halab is not actually the Arabic name for it? I think Halab actually is the European name for Halab, which is Halabi.
Yes, we'll see. Yeah, I think you may be right. It is the Arabic name, but we'll see where that has to do with the legend that I'm gonna mention. Okay. So no problem. Okay, so Aleppo is an ancient Jewish community. It's mentioned in the book of Shmuel. Okay, it's mentioned in the book of Shmuel as existing at some time during the reign of King David. The other name for Aleppo, in Jewish sources, is Aram Tzoba. Okay, Aram Tzoba. In fact, you may have heard that term from the Aleppo Codex. Okay, so the Aleppo Codex, which I don't, again, also a fascinating story I don't want to get into tonight, is a codex, right? That's what it is, which is like not a scroll, but a book type. And it's one of the earliest, might be the earliest, manuscripts of the Tanakh, which we have. It's not a full Tanakh, but of Tanakh, which we have, and it was found in Aleppo, and it's known for its accuracy. The Rambam even talks about it, and it's called in Hebrew the Keter Aram Tzoba, right? So the crown of Aleppo. So Aleppo is mentioned in the book of Shmuel, dating back to the times of King David, and there are a couple of legends which the Jewish community of Aleppo have. One which is that, again, related to King David, is that the great synagogue of Aleppo was believed to have at least a cornerstone or something of that nature was founded by the general of King David, Yoav ben Tsruya. Okay, there is obviously no, you know, historical proof for that, but it's a legend which the Jewish community of Aleppo carries with it. And the other one related to what I was saying before in terms of the name Chaleb. So Chaleb, why, again, this is a legend which the Jewish community of Aleppo has, is that Avraham Avinu, right, no less than Avraham Avinu, on his journey from Ur Kasdim, which is in kind of modern day Iraq, right, Mesopotamia, on his journey from there to the land of Canaan, when God appears to him and tells him to go. So the Jews have a legend that Avraham Avinu, our patriarch, stopped in Aleppo, and there he milked his cows, and that's how it got the name Chaleb, which is Chalav, or Chaleb in Arabic, okay? They have this legend which they trace back to Avraham Avinu. Now, whether or not there's any sort of historical proof for either of those legends is not really important, right? What's important is that they reflect this very strong sense of identity, this very strong importance which the Jews of Aleppo give their origin and their communal origin. Aleppo was a city of great Torah scholarship. It was a very prominent community. And what we have to start seeing is, well, how did they make their way to America? Okay. So this begins in the early 20th century, which may be earlier than many of us think. Okay. So the Jews of Aleppo and the Jews of Syria begin coming to the United States actually in the early 20th century. Aleppo at the time, Syria at the time, right? We're going to jump to 1908. Okay, 1908 is the waning years of the Ottoman Empire. The Ottoman Empire is decimated during the First World War. Okay, so 1908 is the waning years of the Ottoman Empire, and the Young Turks, which eventually brought about the secular country of Turkey, which we know nowadays, succeeded the Ottomans in controlling various areas of the Ottoman Empire, and what they were known as the Young Turks, okay? And what they began doing was conscripting Jews into the army, okay? They began conscripting Jews into the army, And once they started conscripting Jews into the army, so, you know, we may know somewhat of a parallel story from Russia a little earlier, right? So the Jews wanted to avoid this. And this kind of spurred a mass immigration of Jews. And they went to various countries, okay? So they went to England, okay? So some of them made their way to Eretz Yisrael, okay, to Israel. Some of them made their way to England. In fact, in Manchester, there's still a relatively sizable community of Syrian Jews. The parts of South America, Argentina, which that'll become important soon in our story. I believe Panama has a relatively sizable Syrian community, and they make their way to New York, as we know. Okay, and so this is kind of the first wave of Syrian Jews, which begin coming to the United States. This part of the emigration continues until the 1920s. We know in the 1920s in the U.S., immigration laws became much more rigid, as well as after the First World War, right? These had various effects on emigration, but there was a continuous immigration of Jews into this country, of Syrian Jews into this country. The first Syrian rabbi that comes to the United States, we think, arrives in 1910, so relatively early. His name was Rabbi Yitzchak Shalom. Talk about him another time, not our topic for tonight. But again, the Syrian Jewish community, they first settle, okay, perhaps not surprisingly, where else but the Lower East Side. Okay, they first settle in the Lower East Side. As you can imagine, there is strife in between, conflict in between these, right, quote-unquote new immigrants as opposed to the old immigrants, right, the Eastern Europeans. They're each kind of very foreign to each other. Although there are a couple of synagogues that are Syrian synagogues that are founded on the Lower East Side, but they eventually make their way to Brooklyn, okay? And as a community, the center of the community shifts to Brooklyn first, actually, not to where we know of it now, but first actually to Bensonhurst, okay, to the Bensonhurst section of Brooklyn. And then later in the 40s, 50s or so, it begins shifting to what we now know as Flatbush, Gravesend, Midwood, right, where we kind of see the center of the Syrian Jewish community in New York nowadays, right? So kind of all along Ocean Parkway and that whole area. Now, one of the key figures for tonight's story is a Torah scholar who becomes the chief rabbi of the Syrian community in New York, and his name was Rabbi Jacob, officially Kassin, I believe is the real pronunciation. I think many people call him Kassin, okay, but I don't know. I'll probably use them interchangeably, but Rabbi Jacob Kassin is a Talmid Chacham. He's a scholar. He's born and bred in Jerusalem. He's ordained and trained in Jerusalem as a rabbi. He goes back. He comes from a long, long line of rabbis. I believe he's first sent to New York as an emissary, kind of to, generally means a fundraiser, okay, for on behalf of the Jewish community in Jerusalem. But they're so impressed by this Rabbi Kassin, they offer him to become the chief rabbi of their community in Brooklyn. So in 1933, okay, in 1933, again, some of the years are important here. In 1933, Rabbi Kassin comes with his family to New York, to Brooklyn. Okay, I'm gonna share with you a family picture of the Kassins. You'll see what kind of fellow we're talking about here. Okay, bear with me for a second. There we go. That wasn't him, by the way. Okay. Yeah. Okay. So this is him in the long garb. Okay, that's, you know, it's looks like a prominent rabbi from an Arabic culture. Okay, and that's him. He comes with that to New York. You'll see in later pictures, he kind of looks like your I don't mean this in a bad way, kind of run of the mill Ashkenazi rabbi, but in terms of how he dressed. But that was him. Okay, so he becomes the chief rabbi of the Syrian community in New York in 1933. I don't want to go through the entire history of the Syrian community in New York. It's interesting, but it's not really what I want to focus on tonight. Okay. But he comes to New York and this is what he encounters. Okay. So this is where our story begins getting very interesting. Rabbi Kassin, again, he's coming from a very traditional Sephardic community in Jerusalem, which again traces its origins back to Aleppo. And he comes to the United States in 1933. And he sees something that he's never really seen before, right? Which is what? Which is a community heavily, heavily influenced by Americanism, by Westernization, by secularization, okay? And he sees a community that is trying to survive. Did something? Oh, sorry. Let me, hold on. I lost you there for a second. He sees a community, here I am, that's trying to survive economically, right? They come without wealth, without, you know, much economic power, and they're trying to build themselves, right? It's the immigrant story. And that's what he sees. And as a result of that, right, this is kind of also a classic Jewish immigrant story to the United States, is because they have to support their families, because they have to build, or they feel the need that they have to build their businesses. So what are they doing? They're working on Shabbos, okay? So they're working on Shabbos, despite it being a traditional community, they're working on Shabbos because they feel that economic burden. In addition, many of them are opening retail establishments, okay? And not only in New York, right? So New York is saturated to a certain degree. So they're going out to other communities that don't have a Jewish infrastructure, okay? And he sees that all of this is taking its toll on the traditionalism of the Jewish community, and they're beginning, what he sees, Rabbi Kassin, as he comes in 1933, he sees the first seeds, if you will, of assimilation and even of intermarriage, and he gets very scared, okay? So, you know, it's, right, the immigrant story, each community has its own unique elements to it, its own unique factors, and all of that, but the immigrant story, right, we'll focus on the Jewish community for a moment, it kind of repeats itself, right? So what I just described about this later immigration, the Syrian immigration to America, which only begins at the beginning of the 20th century, was clearly very true about, you know, well, first the German immigration and the Eastern European immigration, right? This is a story that repeats itself. But this is what Rabbi Kassin sees when he comes to the United States in 1933. Okay? Any questions until now or comments? Okay, great. So let's stop in New York for a second, and we're going to go, of all places, to Argentina now, okay?
Sorry, I do have a question. Do you have any idea what kind of numbers we are talking about the Jews in Halab before they started living in Syria?
It's a good question. I don't have the numbers. I don't have the numbers. You know, the last Jews left Aleppo or Syria maybe in the early 90s and came to New York. At that point, there was really only a handful. There was a very small number. What?
At the peak, I wonder at the peak, what was the population of the Jews
in Aleppo?
Yeah, because they're talking about a big number. I mean, with a lot of pride, the ones that I've met, that they're from Halab, you know, so.
Well, so the pride is not only, you know, but the pride, I don't think it stems necessarily, you know, it's not quantitative necessarily numbers. In terms of the numbers, it's in terms of the culture and the history, which they carry with them, that they're very proud of. Yeah, Toby. Yeah, go ahead, Toby.
So, you've mentioned a number of times that this is 1933, so it's the depths of the depression in this country.
Yeah.
It almost seems like an odd time for somebody to be starting a new job. But had the depression hit in Syria as well? Was it that, you know, things seemed to be relatively okay, and then he came here and the Jews were dealing with that on top of being immigrants?
Okay, so here's what I know, okay? The depression, for the most part, was worldwide, okay?
Right.
It's, you know, kind of started here, but it was basically a worldwide economic depression. However, the community that, well, remember, he's not from Syria. He's from Jerusalem. Okay.
Right.
So he's what he knows in Jerusalem is a very traditional. Now, you know, I would say, put it like this, right? So already in Jerusalem, he knows that there's such a thing called secular Jews in 1933 for sure, right? Secular Zionists had been coming to you know, Palestine for decades until by 1933. So it's not something he's never seen before, right? But here's the community which he's now being put in charge of, right? So whereas in Jerusalem, perhaps, and I don't know his early history so much, okay? That's not what I really researched for this. My assumption is in Jerusalem, he remained within a little bit more of the insular cloister traditional community. And so whereas he saw such a thing called secular Jews, right, it wasn't part of his community, so to speak, right? But he's brought to the United States specifically to be the rabbi of this community. And so he has to confront it head on, right? Which is not something he was forced to do beforehand. Okay, so let's, unless there are other questions or comments. Okay? Okay, good. So again, he comes in, so I said, okay, so he's here in 1933. We're gonna go back a few years and we're gonna travel to Argentina for a little bit to see what's going on there. So as I mentioned before, with this wave of, as the Syrian Jews are leaving Syria, they're going to various countries around the world, and amongst them is Argentina. Until this day, I believe there is, again, a relatively sizable Syrian Jewish community in Argentina, particularly in Buenos Aires. And the chief rabbi of the Syrian community in Buenos Aires, not so surprisingly, sees something very similar to what Rabbi Kassin sees in New York in 1933. He just sees it a little bit earlier, right? So he gets there a little bit earlier, and he sees again a community that's, forced to work on Shabbos, a community that's beginning to assimilate, right? So all of these various problems that that these immigrant communities are confronting and is bearing down on their traditionalism. And so the rabbi of the Syrian community of Buenos Aires, his name was Rabbi Shaul David Seton, classic Syrian name, Rabbi Shaul David Seton. In 1927, he signs what's called a takana, an edict. That's how the Syrian community refers to it, as the edict or the takana. And the takana, which is instituted by Rabbi Shaul David Seton in Buenos Aires in 1927, okay, signed together with a number of other rabbis, is what? Is that they will not accept any converts who convert to the community for the purposes of marriage. Okay? That's, I'm phrasing it that way. We'll see how this sort of develops. Okay? But he will not accept converts for the purposes of marriage. And in fact, okay, it is even expanded to not accept, I believe the original Argentinian Takana edict was not to accept converts, period. Okay, not to accept anyone who converts to Judaism. Now, what was the motivation for Rabbi Seton in Argentina? What was his motivation for creating this this edict, this Takana? So there are a number of reasons which he gave, okay? So one of the reasons which he gave was where he saw and he evaluated, and again, this was his evaluation, 1927, that there weren't enough learned rabbis in Argentina that could convert people properly and that could act as a proper Beit Din, as a proper court, right, to convert people. And so he was afraid that the conversions were not kosher. Conversions, the rabbis that were conducting them were not appropriately trained. That was one of his reasons given for establishing this policy. Another reason which he established this policy was he felt that, well, the community, right? So the community in Buenos Aires, the general community, the right? Not the converts, but the Jewish community in Buenos Aires was not sufficiently observant. And so a convert is going to convert, and the models which they have in front of them are not models of Jewish observance, which he would want a convert to have, okay? So he makes this takana, this edict, again, their word, of the that the community uses in 1927, forbidding conversion to and within the Jewish community, or to, I should say, the Jewish community, the Syrian Jewish community in Buenos Aires. Okay, so there's precedent in 1927 in Argentina. Let's fast forward again to the 1930s, back to New York. We said Rabbi Kassim confronts this new reality which he sees in New York, okay? And he comes out together with a number of other rabbis in the community with their own edict. And this is, again, depends how you look at it, the famous or infamous edict of the Syrian Jewish community of New York, which, as we will see, as its development is still in effect till today, 2020, okay? So in 1935, I'm going to show you the language of the edict. We'll read through it, okay? In 1935, Rabbi Kassim, together with a number of other rabbis in the community, they write their own edict, their own takana against, this is the question, against what exactly, okay? So I want us to look at the language of the edict, okay? So I'm going to share it on the screen here. Okay, so this is the first one we're going to look at, which you should be able to see, is the original takana, the original edict from 1935. This is a translation from Hebrew, okay? The original one, I saw a picture of the Hebrew one. I wasn't able to download it. I apologize. But in any case, this is a translation of the Hebrew. You see a rabbinical proclamation, Adar 5695, February of 1935, and it's signed. You look at the Hebrew version, it's signed by, actually, you look at the Hebrew version signed by, you know, various rabbis within the Syrian community, chief amongst them Rabbi Jacob Yaakov Kassim. Okay, so the translation here is going to be important, particularly of one line. Okay, in order for us to understand what exactly were they forbidding. Okay, so let's read through it together. They write as follows: having observed the conditions prevailing in the general Jewish community, where some youth have left the haven of their faith and have assimilated with non-Jews. In certain cases, they have made efforts to marry Gentiles, sometimes without any effort to convert them, and other times an effort is made for conversion to our faith, an action which is absolutely invalid and worthless in the eyes of the law of our Torah. Okay, so first thing that we need to know is, stop here for a second, is that according to the strict letter of the law, according to the strict letter of halacha, conversion for the purposes of marriage invalidates the conversion, okay? So I'm going to say that very carefully, okay? That according to the strict letter of the law, a conversion for the purposes of marriage, is not considered to be a valid conversion. In fact, I'm going to read one thing to you. I don't have it here, but I'll read one couple of lines here from the Rambam. The Rambam didn't make this up. He's quoting from the Talmud, okay? Just so we know. Where is this? Oh, here we go. Okay. So the Rambam says, he goes through, you know, various kind of investigations that we have to do. We have to do research when a person comes to convert. One of the questions we have to know is, why do you want to convert? Okay, motivation's important. Okay, so the Rambam goes through various possible motivations that a person may have. Okay, and the Rambam says, again, he didn't make this up, he's citing from the Gemara, Ve'im ishu bodkina charav shema einav natan be'isha yehudit, ve'im isha hi bodkin shema eineha natna be'bachur mi'bachurei Yisrael. Okay, for a man, we check whether he focused his attention on a Jewish woman. For a woman, we check whether she focused her attention on a Jewish man. Okay. The point being that if that is in fact their motivation, again, I'm going to use the term by the strict letter of the law, it invalidates the conversion. Now, what begins happening as the Jews confront modernity, right, 18th century, 19th century in particular, is that these questions become more and more common. That, you know, Jews, Shlomi falls in love with Christina, and Shana falls in love with Christopher, and right, all of these questions and cases begin arising, particularly in Europe, as the communities in Central and then East, afterwards Eastern Europe, begin Western, Central, Eastern Europe, right, begin assimilating. And post-Skim, right, Jewish halakhic decisors have to contend with this. And so that's why I'm saying, according to the strict letter of the law, that does invalidate the conversion. As you all know, okay, from various famous and not as famous cases, there are all kinds of ways, if you will, of dealing with this issue. It doesn't necessarily invalidate the conversion. Okay, again, fascinating topic for another time. But now, okay, so let's get back to the proclamation here of the Syrian community. Okay, so he says that if, right, first paragraph here, they say that in certain cases they have made efforts to marry Gentiles, sometimes without any effort to convert them, and other times an effort is made for conversion to our faith, an action which is absolutely invalid and worthless in the eyes of the laws of our Torah. Okay, so they are adopting the strict letter of the law. Any conversion for the purposes of marriage is 100% invalid according to this. Okay, let's continue. We have therefore bestirred ourselves to build and establish an iron wall to protect our identity and religious integrity, and to bolster the strong foundations of our faith and religious purity, which we have maintained for many centuries, going back to our country of origin, Syria. Again, this very deep identity which they have, and pride in their identity and their traditional identity of being Jews from Syria. Now, we the undersigned, now we get to the crux of the proclamation. We the undersigned rabbis, constituting the religious court together with the executive committee of Magen David congregation and the outstanding laymen of our community, that's not the school, by the way, that's a shul in Brooklyn, laymen of our community, do hereby decree, okay, so listen carefully, with the authority of the Holy Torah, that no male or female member of our community has the right to intermarry with non-Jews, okay, so far so good. This law covers conversions which we consider to be fictitious and valueless. We'll come back to that line. I bolded it and underlined it for a reason. We further decree that no future rabbinic court of the community should have the right or authority to convert male or female non-Jews who seek to marry in our community. Okay, we have followed the example of the community in Argentina. That's why we gave that background, which maintains a rabbinical ban on any of the marital arrangements enumerated above, an edict which has received wholehearted and unqualified endorsement, okay, etc., etc. Let's just read the last paragraph here. Announcements to the effect will be made advising the community not to allow any marriage with children of such converts. We are confident that the Jewish people are a holy people, and they will adhere to the decision of their rabbis and will not conceive of doing otherwise. Okay, I want to leave this on the screen because I want to talk about, well, what exactly were they forbidding? Okay, so anyone want to kind of give a crack at it? What exactly were they forbidding with this original edict in 1935? Anyone? Feel free to unmute yourselves.
For the purpose of marriage, they couldn't convert, basically. It seems originally, at least.
So you think that this original decision, this original policy, was that they simply should not accept any conversion for the purpose of marriage. Okay, anyone have a different opinion as to what this original proclamation was?
Well,
I think against intermarriage.
Intermarriage in general.
Yes.
But what if the person converts? They're saying that's not good either.
Right.
Right.
Well, no. They're saying only that it's for the purpose of marriage. If they had converted beforehand, they would, I would assume, had studied, et cetera, and they're doing it for the purpose of really becoming Jewish because they want to be Jewish. I think that's a totally different situation than marrying. Okay.
Excellent. Okay. So everything sounds, that we've said now, yeah. Sorry.
It sounds like they're worried about the survival of their community, the Syrian Jewish community.
Yeah. And, Rabbi, maybe
and
I'm
so,
jumping.
And so therefore they're forbidding what?
They're forbidding anyone to marry. Well, they're trying to keep them marrying within the community, but certainly marrying Jews.
Okay. Well, right, Rabbi, right.
Maybe I'm jumping ahead, but...
Yeah, no, go ahead.
The Syrians have maintained, I know, in Mexico and perhaps in other communities, a very close allegiance to just marrying, as was suggested, within their own community,
right?
Let alone marrying others. You know, even if you're a Jewish and Ashkenaz or a Jewish and other right. Sephardim,
yeah,
they do not want to dilute, if you will, their identity as Syrian Jews.
Good. Okay, so that is true 100%, right? So the Syrian
Jews... You're referring to, if you will, same-sect marriage.
I'm sorry?
Yeah, you know, well, no, is the way they want Syrians to marry within the community. What you were saying was basically, if you will, same-sect marriage.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, oh, okay. So, correct. So the Syrian, you know, I would say yes, right? So within the Syrian Jewish community up until today, it is much more common for them to marry within the their own community, although it's becoming, I don't know the reality in Mexico, you definitely know it better than I do. Within the American Jewish community, American Syrian community, it is becoming, you know, more common that they marry not within the Syrian community per se. But I want to get back to this proclamation, okay? So if you look at the part that I underlined and I bolded, okay, there is a very critical, right? We're always taught in elementary school that punctuation is critical. The comma over here in this sentence is very, very critical. Okay, and I will tell you that the comma does not appear in the original Hebrew. It does appear, though, in this English translation. Okay, so I'm going to pretend there's no comma in this sentence. Okay, I'm going to read it without a comma. This law covers conversions which we consider to be fictitious and valueless. What does that mean?
No, that conversions.
That there are specific conversions that we consider to be fictitious and valueless, but there are other conversions that we considered to not be fictitious and valueless, right? That's what the meaning is if I take away that comma. But now let's read it as it's written with the comma. This law covers conversions, comma, which we consider to be fictitious and valueless. So fictitious and valueless now with the comma is coming to modify what?
Conversions.
Conversions in general, right? So right, how the punctuation is critical over here. Right? So if you read it with the comma, now, again, the Hebrew, the original Hebrew doesn't have the comma. So the comma is more, I would say, reflective of different understandings as opposed to, you know, it being what people look at in terms of coming to those understandings. But with the comma, right, is essentially how people have understood this decree. That they're not only forbidding conversions for the purpose of marriage, which really was their motivation, but essentially they're saying, you know what, we want no part of any convert entering our community, okay? And they're doing it, in their mind, and I said, I'm not voicing an opinion or endorsing anything, I'm just presenting the facts here, right? So in their minds of the rabbis, and not just the rabbis, and the lay leaders, as they said, of the community in 1935, right, they're doing this thinking that this is going to be, as they said, right, the iron wall, okay, to protect our identity and religious integrity, is they essentially looked outside of their community and they saw all kinds of conversions being done and all kinds of marriages being performed. And they said, you know, well, a lot of those are—they're not real, right? There's nothing sincere about those conversions. And so, when the conversion is not sincere, and it's really solely for the purpose of marriage, so that really does give doubt right? In terms of the sincerity and the truthfulness of that conversion, and henceforth that convert. And they say, we want nothing to do with that, so we're going to put what they call, build what they call an iron wall, and we're going to say, again, essentially, whether or not this was their original intent, but this is essentially how it's understood, no conversions, period. Okay, so what does that mean? Okay, so hold off with the questions for a second. Okay, let me just explain. That means, A, for the most part, they're not performing conversions. Okay, I'll give you one exception in a second. Okay, they're not performing conversions within the Syrian Jewish community in New York and seems in other places as well. And they're also not accepting conversions. So that means as follows, okay? And just to clarify one point. Okay, and they'll say this till today, is from what I understand. Let's say a man or a woman, it doesn't matter, right, goes through a 100% sincere conversion in an Ashkenazic Beit Din, right, in the U.S., in Israel, and wherever it is, it's a 100% recognized sincere conversion in a recognized Beit Din, okay? And then they come and they say, I want to marry so-and-so from the Syrian community. Right? So they're not going to say your conversion is not good. Right? They don't say, well, we're rejecting your conversion. Right? They're not casting doubt on the conversion. Right? Let's say they come to them with a proof, a certificate or something like that, the rabbinate of Israel, for argument's sake. Right? So they're not going to say, we don't recognize this conversion and we don't consider you Jewish. They're going to say, we consider you Jewish. But you can't marry someone from our community. I'm sorry, we have this takana, we have this communal edict, and therefore we have to abide by it, right? So they don't cast doubt on the Jewishness of the person necessarily, okay? But they still will abide by the takana, by this edict. One exception, which I will mention, is from what I understand, they still will convert children for purposes of adoption. Okay, so that's called the Ger Katan. A whole other topic in halacha. Generally, there are more leniencies when it comes to that. So from what I understand, even within the Syrian community today, they will, if it's for purposes of adoption and it's a child, a minor, so then they will perform that conversion. From what I understand, that's basically the only exception. Okay. Any comments?
Rabbi, may I say something?
Please.
As a person that has lived in Middle East among the Muslims, just like the Syrians did, you see, conversion in Middle East, conversion Islam of non-Jews was impossibility. Because by Islamic law, if somebody converts, leaves Islam, he can be executed. He gets the death penalty. And okay. That's what you hear in Pakistan, and somebody became Christian, and the whole other thing, they were going to kill and all this thing. Mm-hmm. So the Jews in all these countries, Islamic countries, they were not used to ever having a convert. So they always looked at this like impossibility. They looked at the convert like it's a goy. It's not this right. Such thing doesn't exist to them. So that's therefore, really to so start I, with the I, community, right. The adults, the older really people have this thing in the right, back so, of so their that, mind.
Right. So that's really interesting. I appreciate you bringing it up. Right, that's fascinating, right? So what you're saying is there might be, you know, some sort of cultural
built-in resistance to it, as if.
Yeah, cultural resistance. Very good, right? Which they've sort of absorbed. From their communities, their surrounding society. Right. That may be true, and it's a fascinating point. I would love to to look into it more. The only thing I would say in response to that, right, is that halacha. There is vast amounts of halachic literature about conversion, right? I read to you from the Rambam. I mean, that was just a very small snippet. I mean, there's vast amounts of halachic literature about conversion from the Talmud and on, right? So it's clearly something which is valid, when done properly according to halacha. I want to just move on because it's 8:45 already. I do want to move on a little bit just to get through some other interesting points. Okay, so it's a little shocking, right? That they made this edict. It's for the most part still in effect, and again, we'll see what I mean by that. But it's not without precedent here in the United States. So I gave you one other, just one other source here, just to show a little bit, but one other precedent here in the United States from 1763 from Congregation Sheirith Israel, the Spanish and Portuguese synagogue. Again, it's also Sephardic, but very different and having nothing to do with each other. Okay, so let's not get them confused. 1763, okay, so almost 200 years before that, okay, 170 or so years before that, okay, the Congregation Sheirith Israel in 1763 had a policy, if you will, prohibiting any of the officers of the congregation aiding or assisting in making proselytes, right, converts, or performing the marriage ceremony of any Jew to a proselyte, and which is at present the law of the congregation, penalty of $100. All right, so it's actually interesting you find this in other ways. Congregations,
how much would that be today?
They fined people, okay? So I don't know, Toby, maybe in your job next, your presidency, maybe you want to reenact that, but bring that back. But in any case, okay, Congregation Sheirith Israel has this 1763, okay? Other congregations in the 19th century had similar policies forbidding any sort of a conversion or marrying converts, okay? So it's not without precedent here in the United States. Now, one thing that has been pointed out, I'll come back to this soon. One thing that is pointed out is that, well, if we think about the precedent from Argentina, which they were, you know, kind of relying upon, when you think about that precedent, so, right, we said that there were a couple of different reasons given. One was that they, he felt that there was no Beit Din, right, there weren't enough learned rabbis to perform a proper conversion. That wasn't true of the Syrian community in 1935 when this edict was established, right? I mean, it was clear that there were enough rabbis who, if they wanted to perform a conversion according to halakha, that they could, okay? So it's interesting that they're relying upon what the precedent of the Argentinian community, but yet that reason is not really relevant in New York in 1935. Another reason which was given in Argentina mm-hmm. was that there were not enough observant people to serve as a model for converts. Also, even though there were all these issues of non-observance and assimilation in the Syrian community in the 1930s, there were fully observant people that could serve as a model. So it's really interesting that even though they're relying on the precedent of the Argentinian community, right? The reasons are not exactly, the realities are not exactly parallel. Okay. Now, when I say that this edict, right, this proclamation, this policy is still in effect, is because A, it's still in effect. Okay. But it's been reaffirmed. It's been reaffirmed throughout at various intervals. Okay. So I'm going to come back to the next source that I want to see together is the first reaffirmation in 1946. Okay, so what happens 1946, you know, Syrian Jewish men go off to fight in World War II just like everyone else, and they come back and they want to start a family just like everyone else. And what the rabbis saw, or what the community saw, was that they were sometimes, you know, falling in love or meeting these non-Jewish women, and they wanted to convert them in order to bring them into the community. So they reaffirm the original edict, and they also clarify it. And here in their clarification, okay, very interesting, maybe shocking to some of us, okay, they clarify what are the penalties, okay? So what are the consequences if you go ahead and you still marry someone who's converted? Right? So let's say you have them converted outside of the community, because the community themselves is not going to perform the conversion. You have them converted outside of the community, and then you want to now join, you know, kind of be a part of the community in which you grew up in, the Syrian community in New York, okay? So they clarify as follows. Our community will never accept any converts, male or female, for marriage. Again, they word it that way, but for the most part, they don't accept converts at all. The rabbi will not listen to what the consequences are. The rabbi will not perform any religious ceremonies for such couples, marriages, circumcisions, bar mitzvahs, etc. So if they have a child and they want to have a bris for that child, find somewhere else to do it, right? They're not going to do it in their shuls, bar mitzvah, etc. In fact, the congregation premises will be banned to them for use of any religious or social nature. Okay? Very strong language. They continue. The misadrim, it's like kind of like the gabaim, right? The leaders of the congregation will not accord any honors to the convert or one married to a convert, such as offering him an aliyah to the Sefer Torah. So again, you know, a man marries a woman who converts, they do the conversion outside the community, comes back to his family, can't get an aliyah in their shul. In addition, the aforesaid person, male or female, will not be allowed to purchase a seat permanently or for the holidays in our congregations, can't attend our services on Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. And perhaps the most striking consequence is the last one, after death of said person, he or she is not to be buried in the cemetery of our community, known as Road Fate Tzedek, regardless of financial considerations. Okay, what do you think? Any reactions? It's pretty shocking. Okay, it's pretty shocking. Again,
the one
I'm not here
that jumps out at me is the last line. The one that jumps out at me particularly is the last line in 4, regardless of financial considerations.
You could have donated millions of dollars to the shul or to the community throughout your life. We're not going to bury you in our cemetery, right? It's shocking. I'm not here to judge. I'm not here to voice an opinion. You know, again, we could talk about it another time, but it's shocking. Okay. They're basically saying that we are shunning you from religious life within our community. And now I want to get back to
work.
I'm sorry.
And Howard asked a good question.
What?
Did it work?
Okay, so hold on. We'll get to that. It is an excellent question. We'll see. Okay. But I want to get back actually to a comment which Albert made, right? In terms of the strong identity. We're talking about the community in Mexico City. It is very true about the community here as well. Where there is this just incredibly strong identity. Again, they're not just Jews, they're Syrian Jews, right? That's very much part of their identity. And so to shun someone and the kind of the locus of the community is around these religious institutions and practices, right? So even if you're not observant within the Syrian community, you're still, you know, again, I'm generalizing here, but there's a certain level of traditionalism where, again, right, much of it is focused and centered around synagogue, a ritual, again, religious life. So if you're shunned religiously from the community, what essentially the community is saying is you're shunned socially from our community, right? Because look at these, right? Okay, you can't be buried. That's horrible, right? But for the person, again, I'm not judging here, but right? So that's one thing. But right, you come back, you can't daven, you can't pray with your family on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, right? You want to come back for the holidays, you got to find yourself another shul, okay? You got to go daven with the Ashkenazim, Nebuch, right? You can't come and daven in their shuls. You can't get, right? You come back for a family simcha, you can come to shul, but you're not going to get any sort of honor, any sort of aliyah, right? Your child needs a bris or bar mitzvah, right? Find somewhere else to do it, okay? So you're essentially being shunned socially through the mechanism of shunning them religiously, okay? There's another, I'm just going to run through a little bit, okay? Because I don't want to take up too much more time. There's another reaffirmation in 1972, in which I couldn't get my hands on the text of it. By the way, I need to mention this. Much of, not all of it, but much of this is from a master's thesis that was written by a woman who lives in the community, part of the community. Her name is Sarina Rofe. It's a wonderful, wonderful, if anyone wants me to send it to them, I'm happy to send it to them. It's really fascinating. So much of this is from her master's thesis that she wrote, but if I'm not mistaken, the 1972 reaffirmation essentially dictates that not only will, right, it reaffirms everything from 1946 that we just mentioned, but it says your children will not be able to attend our schools. Okay, so if you have a child of one of those marriages, that child can't attend, you know, whatever, various Syrian educational institutions. Okay, now let's fast forward here to 1984. Okay, 1984, there's another reaffirmation of the edict. Okay, and here there are a couple of other additions. Okay, they read as follows. Whereas throughout the history of our community, our rabbis and lay leaders have always recognized the threat of conversions and the danger of intermarriage and assimilation, have issued warnings and proclamations concerning these evils in February 1935, February 1946, and May 1972. Now, therefore, we assembled rabbis and presidents of the congregations and organizations. Now, pay attention to the words here, of the Syrian and Near Eastern Jewish communities of Greater New York and New Jersey. Why is that important? So if you know a little bit of the demographics, okay, so the... Right. If you go to Flatbush nowadays, if you go to Brooklyn nowadays, so right. We kind of call and generalize as the Syrian Jewish community is actually made up of Jews who trace their origin to Syria, Jews who trace their origin to Lebanon, to various parts of the Middle East. And many of them, because of the prominence and because the Syrians came over earlier and built institutions and so forth. Right, so many Jews from these various other places, many of them got swallowed up within the general Syrian Jewish community. So this is important. The wording here is that now this policy does not only is not only for Jews of Syrian origin, but also those that affiliate with the Syrian Jewish community, but they could be from other places, right? So you could have an Iraqi shul, let's say, right, in Brooklyn or parts of New Jersey, whatever it is, right,
yeah.
Who, they're Iraqi, they're not Syrian, okay, but they affiliate somehow with the Syrian Jewish community, so they're also bound by this policy, okay, so that's also important in terms of it's been broadened to include more people, okay, right, New York and New Jersey, we know that there's a very, there's a large Jewish, Syrian Jewish community in Deal, New Jersey. Okay, do now and hereby reaffirm these proclamations and pledge ourselves to uphold, enforce, and promulgate these regulations. This is very interesting. At the end, we further declare that Shabbat Shuvah, right, the Shabbos in between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur of each year, be designated as a day to urge our people to rededicate themselves to these principles. I imagine what that means is that, you know, they kind of read it out loud every Shabbos Shuvah in their synagogue. Come on, maybe the rabbi gives a speech about it, right? So they've designated each year, a particular day, each year on which the community as a whole is reminded of this, right? So that they shouldn't forget. And as the way they put it, we rededicate ourselves to these principles. I've never been in the Syrian shul on Shabbos Shuvah. I have one thing that you will see. I don't know if it's in every Syrian shul in the New York and New Jersey area, but I believe it is very common, and it might even be in every shul. Proclamation
right.
is, I'm going to mute, sorry, right, that this proclamation is in fact hanging. In every shul, you will walk into a Syrian shul and you will see this proclamation hanging there, okay, essentially, and you will know that this is our policy, okay, and what does that show you? That shows you just how seriously they take this, okay? I've seen it. I was in a shul in Deal, and I saw it hanging on the wall, okay? As I wasn't familiar with it at all, but I saw it hanging on the wall, and it's there, okay? So it's something that's clearly, and that was a few years ago, okay? Something that's clearly taken very seriously. I want to just, two last things, because I don't want to take, it's 9 o'clock, but I just want two last things that I think are very interesting. So in this master's thesis that I just mentioned, she quotes about 15 or so, maybe 20 kind of cases, real life cases where this policy was put to the test, okay? And how the Syrian community stood by it, okay? Despite various factors kind of working in favor of the other side, where they stood by their principles, right? And they stood by this policy that was being put to the test. So one of them I just want to look at, which again, I find to be just striking, really, really striking, and you'll see why. Okay, so she brings it as case B, right? It's the second one that she's. Okay, I just copied and pasted it here. So you see, this is the case. An observant girl from Los Angeles whose mother converted through a non-Orthodox conversion, okay, came to Deal, New Jersey, met a boy, meaning a Syrian Jewish boy, and they wanted to get married. The girl did not know there was a problem with her mother's conversion, right? So the mother converted through a non-Orthodox conversion, which was not obviously going to be recognized within the Orthodox community. She wanted to marry the Syrian boy. She had no idea that there was a problem with her mother's conversion. However, the boy's family found out her mother converted, again, non-Orthodox, and they spoke to none other than Rabbi Ovadia Yosef, chief Sephardic rabbi in Israel. Now, when you say the words Rabbi Ovadia Yosef to, well, really to anyone, it should be, right, who knows a little bit about halacha and rabbinics in the past, you know, 50 years, I mean, that name should make you shudder. And certainly within the Sephardic community, he is known. Right, he died about 5 years ago, I think, but he had close to 1 million people at his funeral in Israel, and he's the giant of Sephardic halacha in the past, I don't know, 30, 40, 50 years, okay? So they spoke to none other than Rabbi Ovadia Yosef, chief Sephardic rabbi in Israel at the time. After the problem was discovered, the girl went through a serious conversion course in Israel. Rabbi Yosef converted her in Israel, so he himself, you know, oversaw the conversion. And he, along with other prominent rabbis, signed a declaration of conversion for her. He signed her certificate of conversion. When the girl returned to Brooklyn, the Sephardic Rabbinical Council refused to accept her. Okay, so imagine that, right? You have a certificate signed by Rav Ovadia Yosef, okay? And they say, nope, sorry, we're not accepting you. Although everybody agreed she was 100% properly converted, because the grammar here is a little bit weird, because of the precedent it could set, meaning they agreed she was a 100% kosher convert, but they weren't going to accept her because they didn't want to create any sort of precedent of going against their edict, their policy. They felt that if they allowed it, then others might pursue a similar course of action and the takana would have no force. Right? They said what we call in halacha, lo plug, we're not going to make any sort of exceptions. If I make an exception for you, I'm going to have to make an exception for other people. They said the child's conversion could not be accepted. In that case, listen to this. Rabbi Yosef came to New York. He flies special to New York for this and read the declaration of conversion with the Sephardic Rabbinical Council. He said it was a sincere, rigorous conversion, but they refused to accept it. Rabbi Ovadia Yosef is standing in front of them and testifying himself that he oversaw the conversion and that it is sincere. And what do they say? They say, thank you for coming, Rabbi Ovadia, but we're not going to convert him. Right? I would say, chutzpah, right? I mean, I wouldn't have the guts to say that to Rabbi Ovadia, right? Most people, but certainly not to Rabbi Ovadia Yosef, okay? And they say, thank you so much. We recognize it's a sincere conversion, but we can't accept her because we don't want to create this precedent. Finally, the couple got married anyway, right? They went to some other rabbi, maybe Rabbi Ovadia married them, I don't know. And the husband goes to shul in the community, but he can't get an aliyah, as we saw was their policy. Oh, I didn't have that on the screen. I'm sorry. Okay. So, right. It's mind boggling, right? So Rav Ovadia Yosef, the greatest Sephardic sage in the past 50 years, is standing there in front of the Syrian Beit Din and literally testifying on his own that he oversaw the conversion. He signed the certificate. He's 100% sincere. And they say to Rav Ovadia, thank you for coming. You know, you might as well get back on the next plane. We're not going to accept it. Okay. It's mind boggling. Mm-hmm. What it does show you though, is what, just how principled they are in maintaining this policy. Okay. So you see, it's been reaffirmed numerous times. As I mentioned, it's hanging in their shuls. Right? They mention it, they remind people of this policy, and it is something that is clearly important to maintaining their identity. So I want to just end off with the question, I think it was Howard who asked, well, has this worked? Okay, has this worked in terms of their objective was to prevent assimilation, okay? So has this worked? So I don't have numbers in front of me, and I don't know if there are numbers, okay? The demographics of the Syrian, of the Brooklyn, we'll talk about the Brooklyn community because that's really A, the largest, and B, where this has been focused. Okay, the demographics of Brooklyn's Sephardic community, as this Mrs. I don't think she's a doctor, but Rofe points out in her thesis, they do show an opposite trend from the general American Jewish community, right? The growth of yeshivot, synagogues, communal organizations, and, right, what their main objective was, okay, seems to have come true in terms of the prevention of intermarriage and assimilation. So again, I don't know if there are actual numbers in terms of the rates of intermarriage, but they are significantly, significantly lower. I've seen some estimates at something like less than 3% or something like that, okay? Whereas in the American Jewish community, it's above 50%, okay? So you see that, okay, so the trend has been that, yes, their objective has been accomplished. Now, the only thing, the only question you have to ask yourself is, as with any demographic or statistical study, and certainly one which has all of this history behind it, well, can you attribute it to this one factor, right? So it's very hard when dealing with these sorts of questions to attribute a particular trend to one very specific factor. So if you were to ask, well, did this a policy accomplish what its objective was? So the answer is the community accomplished its objective. But part of the question is, well, was it only due to this factor? So those that continue to be proponents of this policy will answer, well, yeah, right? They'll say that, yes, this policy certainly has been the main factor in stemming the tide of assimilation, which is exactly what we set out to do in 1935, and is exactly, you know, the plague which has struck American Jews in general, and it hasn't been as much of a problem for us. Now, you could say that there are other factors involved. Again, the fact that the community has been able to build more schools, right, and give their children stronger education. The fact that the community has grown in terms of building more and more institutions of learning and of prayer and of social services and everything, right, which creates this very strong communal structure. So if you were to ask me, again, I'm not a demographer, I'm not a sociologist, I would say that, yeah, it certainly has, you know, probably quite a bit to do with maintaining, or I should say with preventing assimilation, but it's not, I wouldn't point to the policy itself as being the sole factor, but perhaps what the policy has helped contribute to and be what the policy reflects, which is a very strong communal identity. Remember, where they, you know, if you speak to as Syrian Jews, for many of them, they're not just Jews, they're Syrian Jews, right? It's a very big part of their identity. And so that in and of itself, this policy, I think, whether or not it's accomplished it, but it's certainly reflective of that maintenance of identity, which has helped them in stemming that tide and then not being caught up in those waves of assimilation that the rest of American Jewry has. So again, what we saw tonight, as opposed to some of the other lectures that we learned together, was, right, here was a community that is confronted with modernity. And I said, I'm not using this word in a bad way, right? They're fearful of the effects of modernity, right? They're fearful of the effects of integration and westernization. And they've adopted one particular strategy, which again, I'm not voicing my opinion on, but they've adopted one particular strategy which they've used to, as they, the words, I think the phrase which they use in the original edict is so strong and so telling, right? Their objective was to build an iron wall, right, from in the face of assimilation and in the face of intermarriage. Okay, so I don't know if there are any questions or comments.
Rabbi, I just wanted to say that the Mashadi community of Great Neck, they adopted the same thing a few years ago.
Oh, really?
They wrote exactly the same thing, but they said about Aliyah. I don't know if they said anything about the cemetery. Of course, having lived for 50 years among the Ashkenazis, among the American Jews, I mean, I was very much against it, but they wouldn't ask me. I wasn't part of any decision or anything like that. But I was scared of it. I thought maybe the rabbis should have put it in a way that they could have exceptions from time to time, but they did it, and that's and I think what it does is psychologically, when a young guy wants to date a girl that he's afraid she's not 100% Jewish to start with, he'll be scared to do to date, which happens among the Syrians, I imagine. That's why you have a lot less often marrying and going to an Ashkenazi rabbi and said, "You marry us."
Oh yeah, I mean 100%.
Even if the conversion 100%, they're afraid to start.
It creates, and this was their objective, right? It creates a tremendous amount of pressure.
In that sense, among the Mashadis, most probably the success as well. The percentage that will try it will be very small, that you maybe would want it, but even that percentage will be scared to try it because they're afraid they'll be completely thrown out of the community.
Yeah, you're putting it the right way, right? They're scared, and that was their objective, was to scare people from doing this. Right.
And that's 100%. What this one did, was for the same purpose too. The one Among Mashadis was for exactly the same purpose, because there were
I wasn't aware that the Mashadi community did that. Interesting.
Rabbi, I have a question.
Go ahead, please, Aline.
Okay, what I want to know is that did this policy cause tension between the Orthodox communities of the Assyrians and the Ashkenazim? I mean, how did the Ashkenazi community react to this? Did they know much about it?
So great question. So I'll say two things. Number one is, even within the Syrian community, it has caused some tension. For instance, I wasn't familiar with this particular rabbi, but apparently one of the leading rabbis of the community, by the name of Rabbi Matlub Abadi, again, kind of a classical Syrian Jewish name, he was one of the leading scholars in the community for quite some time, from the 30s till I think he died in the 1970s. He never accepted it. He felt, like we said earlier, right? You can say whatever you want about, you know, your objective and your motivation. Listen, open up a Shulchan Aruch, open up a Gemara, right? Halacha recognizes the institution of conversion. And 36 times in the Torah, we're told to love the convert, right? So this poses a lot of questions in terms of how do you, kind of get around those 36 admonitions in the Torah. But the point being, right, so even within the community, there's some controversy. In terms of from outside of the community, so in this master's thesis, if I can pull it up for 1 second, she does reference how one particular segment of the Ashkenazi community, give me 1 second, here, okay, so I don't know if you know the name Rabbi Herbert Bomzer. Rabbi Bomzer was a rabbi in Flappish. You know the name, okay? And he was very involved.
That's my daughter-in-law's grandfather. That's Tova, my Daniel's wife's grandfather. He should rest.
Oh, really? Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah. Great. All right. Very small world. Yeah. Okay. I think he passed away like pretty recently. No? Did I make that
up? A few years ago. And Mrs. Bomzer just died a few weeks ago.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that. Sorry. Okay. So he was very involved in conversions. He lived in Flatbush. He was a rabbi in Brooklyn. I'm just going to read here. It says from her thesis, it says, Rabbi Herbert Bomzer, an authority on Orthodox conversions, lived in close proximity to the Syrian community. He noted that he entered into a verbal agreement with Rabbi Jacob Kassin not to perform conversions of potential spouses of members of the Syrian community, a community geographically adjacent to his Ashkenazic community congregation. Okay, so you see, at least in that one instance of Rabbi Bomzer, who was a well-known rabbi in Brooklyn and was very involved in conversions, he seems, I don't know, it doesn't say whether he supported the policy or not, but he respected it. We'll put it that way. Okay. In terms of coming to, as they call it, a verbal agreement with the rabbis of the Syrian community.
Rabbi, yeah. I guess I was kind of mistaken. I was always under the impression that the Syrians didn't allow their community to marry outside of their community, even to Ashkenazim. I guess it was just discouraged. It wasn't barred.
No, you know, we kind of joke around and say that, you know, when a Syrian marries an Ashkenazi, we kind of joke around and say they intermarried. But I'm not saying they're happy always, but certainly they consider it to be a good marriage. And like I said, you know, the longer, I mean, again, this is kind of your classic immigration story, right? The longer the community is here, the more American they become and the more integrated they become and the more exposed they are to various other segments of the American Jewish community. And so, you know, a Syrian girl or boy goes to college and meets an Ashkenazi boy or girl, right? That's kind of your classic story. So, you know, they're going to marry each other, you know? So yeah, it wasn't historically as common, but becoming more common, yeah.
Among the Mashkedim, it's a great thing, exactly the same thing, Rabbi.
Hold on, one at a time, I'm sorry. What?
I'm saying the Mashkedim Jews in Great Neck have exactly the same issue about they consider intermarriage. The number of Mashkedim Jews in Great Neck that have married Ashkenazis, even Sephardic of other communities, is maybe 5%, maybe.
Yeah. So I would say the only thing, so I think it's a similar story, right? So the only thing is, at this point, the Syrian community is much larger than the Mashadi community.
Sure, you're right.
And they've also been in the U.S. for longer, right? So what you see in this Persian, right, David's referring to the Persian community in Great Neck, a specific part of it, the Mashadi community, right? So I would imagine that as the years go by, right, and they're here for longer, they'll also be more integrated, right? That's kind of the immigrant. Sure.
Exactly.
Except for Rabbi.
Yeah.
And my cousin married a Syrian Jew. Mm-hmm. And his parents, and she's an Ashkenazi Jew, his parents were not thrilled about the marriage. And to this day, the family grew up in Brooklyn. Most of them now live in Deal. There's one piece of the family that's in Florida.
Right.
They're polite to my cousin and their kids and their grandkids, but it's not a community that's super welcoming. We go to affairs, and if we're lucky, after 40-some-odd years, they acknowledge that they know us. So I'm not sure they're so open to Ashkenazi Jews.
You never considered that maybe it's you, right? It's not. No.
It might be me, but it's never David.
No. It's I like you, and I'm just joking. I'm just joking. I would say that there's, you know, as we say in Hebrew, yesh v'yesh, there are some that are probably more welcoming, some that are less. Okay, I'm gonna end here. Thank you all. Okay, feel free to email me or whatever. Okay.
Thank you very much.
For listening.
Shikor.
Thanks.